Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today for the Transgressors Memorial Service, remembering those who have transgressed against the great spirit of inclusion and must forever be cast into the abyss of dead names. Let's join Brother Andrew remembering those who we have lost.
Our first remembrance is for former presidential candidate Kamala Harris for something she had written for her in her forthcoming memoir, 107 Days, The Untold Tale of the Most Incompetent Presidential Campaign in Modern History. In the book, the dazzling half-Indian, half-Jamaican former attorney general of California, who people used to consider newsworthy, admitted that Governor Walz, affectionately known in some circles as Tampon Tim, was not her first choice for vice presidential running mate. According to excerpts witnessed in electronically secure compartmented rooms used to protect state secrets, such as her classified plans for an invasion of Bayran, from leaking prematurely, Harris claimed that Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg would have been, quote, an ideal partner if I were a straight white man. But we were already asking a lot of America to accept a woman, a black woman married to a Jewish man. Part of me wanted to say, screw it, let's just do it. But knowing what was at stake, it was too big of a risk, and I think Pete also knew that, to our mutual sadness. So, in the end, Mamala decided that America is too backward, bigoted, and narrow-minded to vote both for her and a gay white man from South Bend, Indiana. And look, we understand the trepidation. Obviously, the only reasons she didn't win the election were sexism and racism. It had nothing to do with her being a genuinely terrible candidate who somehow was an allegedly successful prosecutor but also couldn't manage to string three words together coherently unless she was praising the virtues of school buses or the fictional book of Ecclesiastics or Venn diagrams. It was racism and sexism that kept her from becoming fully unburdened by what has been. So we sympathize with her fear of naming an openly gay married man without a lisp or even a single left earring, but that's precisely where she failed. Of course she was justified in believing that America is far too bigoted and narrow-minded to accept both a black woman and a gay man. After all, this contempt for the American electorate is completely normal in our party. It's the sort of thing we even preach in our critical race and queer theory seminars. Bringing all those oppressed identity politics checkmarks together in one ticket would have been the intersectionalityist of intersectionalities. Too much holy acronym string for any Midwesterner to accept. But you could have tried. Having the first LGBTQ2SIA+ VEEP candidate would have gone a long way toward preparing America for accepting the eventual first LGBTQAFOE- president. Wait, which version did I use before? It doesn't matter, it's all a letter salad anyhow. Besides, even if she failed to get butt-edge-edge elected, that's perfectly okay. Remember what the 53rd principle of wokeism tells us. In politics, it's always nobler to fail gloriously in trying to do the right thing than it is to succeed in doing something that can actually be accomplished. After all, it is only in failing that we truly succeed. True words indeed, and after all, no Democrat since Jimmy Carter has been better at failing than Kamala Harris. So she should have known. One of our greatest virtues is the utter joy we take in not winning over and over again. And of course, in this case, she lost anyway, which means she accomplished nothing other than proving that President Never Ever Say His Name is really good at defeating female opponents. In fact, he's the only one who's done it twice, to two different women. So for willful failure to fail, and for denying America its first chance to elect two members of the Church of the Holy Word Salad, Kamala Harris, we cast thee out, woe unto all who offend.
Woe unto all who offend!
Second, performative male contests. In case you haven't heard about this dastardly new trend, college campuses across the United States are hosting satirical competitions in which men make fun of other men by pretending to be the kind of men who deliberately dress and accessorize themselves to be more appealing to woke feminist women. While it has always been true that men strive to seduce women by abandoning any sort of personal identity and instead presenting themselves as whatever they believe women want them to be at that particular week in history, the practice has taken a turn recently, since the advent of modern feminism. In the old days, you see, men would build muscles through working on their bodies, or build muscle cars through working on those bodies, or learn to play bass guitar, or memorize poems, or become good at football, or practice the Carlton, or wear excessive amounts of Dracar Noir. But then, in the aftermath of the sexual revolution, women's suffrage, and the advent of female engagement in politics, many men learned a different strategy: appear to be a feminist. Their rationale was obvious. If you want to get lucky, become appealing to the women who reject conservative morals like, you know, monogamy, abstinence, and chastity, because liberal chicks put out. So they learn to champion female causes, chant female slogans, and dress like female men dress. Well, since this was obviously being done by a lot of men who don't really believe in our cause and who therefore shouldn't be putting on our feminist accoutrements, our culture is not your costume after all, the idea of mocking the performative male was born. So in these contests, men make fun of men pretending to be feminists by pretending to be feminists. They adopt a sort of curated softness by wearing wired headphones, sipping iced matcha drinks, and pretentiously carrying around copies of Maya Angelou or Gertrude Stein with intentionally large print on the cover so it's easier to see what they're pretending to read. They wear unthreatening white t-shirts and carry tote bags with labubus clipped on the straps, perhaps even wearing a kafaya around their necks, carrying vinyl records, sporting ironic mustaches, listening to Indigo Girls or Lofi, and generally doing anything they can to avoid giving macho vibes or signals of toxic masculinity. The ideal is somewhere between Pedro Pascal and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. Anything to appear sensitive, new-agey, and non-threatening, like a good little ally. Of course, the problem with all of this is that it makes a mockery out of men who really are sensitive, new-agey, and non-threatening. You know, actual men without any manhood, the kind of men that many feminists really want men to become. And by making fun of men who deliberately keep unkempt hair, two-day beards, and play acoustic guitar, these college contests are discouraging men everywhere from participating in our most sacred sacrament, the holy virtue signal. Fake it until you make it is literally our whole concept. Pretend to be woke long enough, and eventually cognitive dissonance will kick in and turn you into precisely the sort of emasculated, unisex, gender-free male mannequin that the modern feminist desires. A sort of pet she can occasionally reward with some actual light petting or a granola chew toy. So do we just want to sit idly by and let all the work we've done to teach men to debase themselves for a little female attention so that fewer and fewer of them actually become the sort of men who do productive things in society get squandered? Of course not. So down with performative male contests and up with performative males. Celebrate the anti-man, the submissive man, the non-threatening drinker of non-fat soy mocha lattes and ginger tea. Restore masculinity to its rightful place under the dominating heel of the enlightened Birkenstock stiletto. Be proud of your satchel and your wired headphones and your non-aggressive, limp-wristed scrolling pose. We see you, and we honor you for sacrificing your gender on the altar of modern asexuality. Woe unto all who offend.
Woe unto all who offend.
Finally, and I know this one may come as a shock to you, but our highest honor this week, the corduroy vest with hemp ribbons dripped in patchouli oil, is being awarded to Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer for the outstanding work he's done facilitating a society in which citizens can turn each other into the government for non-compliant behavior. This week, Uthmeyer announced the creation of a web portal through which anyone can report on their fellow Floridians, people who they think are a risk of engaging in political violence. Of course, people can already do this through ordinary law enforcement mechanisms, but Uthmeyer has improved on this long-standing availability in two important ways. First, by centralizing the reporting page, the Attorney General is allowing the creation of a really first-class database of citizen information, people who might be viewed as non-compliant or rebellious or independence-oriented. Of course, he's only doing this for what he says are threats of violence, but once the hotline and the information gathering network are created, we can certainly turn it to whatever purpose we subsequently desire, and trust me, we will. Second, and this is our favorite part, he's done such fantastic work to normalize the idea that it's up to all of us, collectively, to police each other and to make sure that our neighbors and acquaintances know they can be ratted out to the authorities if we don't like what we see them saying online or doing in person. You see, one of the biggest struggles in establishing the kind of authoritarian society we hope for are those silly American notions of personal privacy, individual liberty, tolerance, and freedom from government oversight and intrusion. Some Americans even take these ideas as far as to say absurd things like stay in your own lane, mind your own business, and don't be a rat fink. But of course, if we're ever going to have the sort of widespread social control we need to really bring forth the utopia of the compliant, we need people to believe that government and your fellow Americans have every right to tell you how to live, to spy on you, and then to send your screenshots over to the authorities if you're not following the rules. It's everything we've been trying to do through homeowners associations, TSA security searches, anonymous animal welfare and DCF hotlines, and even the report abuse features on every social media platform. Policing our neighbors is everybody's business, and we're just so proud that someone who is otherwise our enemy, a conservative Republican, or so he says, will so willingly help us in our cause by actually implementing a thought crime hotline. So whether you call it Tattletales for Liberty or Snitches for Freedom or Collaborators for a Cleaner Florida or something, you know, more slogany like Narcs of the Sunshine State Unite, we're just glad the Florida GOP has finally embraced the idea that informants are really just people who care enough to turn you in. Woe unto all who offend.
Woe unto all who offend.
Before you leave, we want you all to sign up in the back for one of the three seminar sessions this month on calculated use of fake rapture dates to make Christians appear stupid. This week's event was a smashing success where our agents managed to persuade millions of people who don't actually read their Bibles that the return of Jesus can be known and was happening on Tuesday. Of course, when nobody got raptured, it made people laugh at all the dumb Christians and also scoff at the idea that Jesus might ever eventually come back. Our goal is to do this again at least three times in the next 5 years. We're amazed at how well it works every time, but if they keep falling for it, who are we to stop taking advantage of their gullibility? Am I right?
And now, brethren, sisterin, and otherin, having been cleansed of these hurtful words, give each other the holy virtue signal and go forth and transgress no more.